Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger.
Good dawning to you, friend. Welcome to Heavenly Shows and Unnecessary Letters, a podcast where we watch and then talk about a production of every single play written by William Mary Shakespeare, who needs no introduction. But we do. So I'm Tammy Sarah Lindy.
And I'm Luke O'Hagan.
This week on Heavenly Shows and Unnecessary Letters, we watched As You Like It, directed by Basil Coleman for the BBC in 1978, and shot on location at Glamis Castle in Scotland, written in 1599 by the William Shakespeare.
Our original intention was to watch the 2006 Kenneth Branagh directed film adaptation of As You Like It, but as we were organising what productions we were going to watch of which plays, I went through the BBC Television Shakespeare, which is a set of productions that were filmed from 1975 to 1985, producing every single Shakespeare play for BBC Television. And as I was going through those, I happened upon the cast list for As You Like It, which was, as we said, made in 1978, and it stars a 27-year-old Helen Mirren. So we decided, that sounds like a great idea, we should do that. So we did. We watched this one instead, and we had a great experience, I think.
Something like that.
Yes.
Do you want to explain the synopsis?
Yes. So we're going to give you a synopsis for every play, just in case you haven't seen it before. But we're not going to go through everything. Some of these plays are quite long. They have quite winding plots. So instead of giving you a 15-paragraph synopsis, we're going to give you a one-tweet-length synopsis, 280 characters. So, take it away, Tammy.
Here goes. Rosalind, the daughter of the deposed and exiled former Duke, is exiled by her uncle, the new Duke. She goes to the Forest of Arden, where she hides disguised as a man, is wooed by her professional wrestler boyfriend, and ends up in a mass 70s wedding officiated by an actual god.
So,
yes.
Let's start with the play. What did you think of the play?
I think it's a weird play. I think that the play itself is odd and strange, and I don't know that I liked it.
Well, I mean, we're very careful going into this whole process. They're not all great.
No.
Like, Shakespeare does fantastic plays, but not all of his plays are great. Not all of them have aged as well as some of the others.
Oh, is aging really a thing that is... No, I don't think aging is even a part of my consideration on this.
Not for this one.
Okay, not for this one.
So thematically, it's a bit strange because a lot of the great Shakespeare plays have sort of big bombastic themes. They deal with betrayal and love and, you know, all these fantastic themes. Whereas this play's overarching theme seems to be how great it is to be outside.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is that bit where the court jester dude and a shepherd are, like, walking through a field waxing lyrical on the pros and cons of living in court versus living in a field.
Yeah, well, you know, outside is really great, and they say that over and over again. The entire second act is dedicated to guys camping in a field.
Yes.
And to bring it back to the adaptation... So this was filmed in Scotland. It was actually filmed in Scotland during the spring. And it's just about the least intimidating looking forest I've ever seen in my life. Like, it's not threat. Like, the idea that the Duke and this Duke's men have been exiled to this forest to live out their days is you know, not really supported by the setting that they're in. It's quite lovely. It's like lovely glades that they lounge in, and it's very unusual.
It's strange.
But I suppose the whole point of these BBC television Shakespeare adaptations is to create a canon for Shakespeare, like a complete recorded canon, so everything is in there and you can go and watch everything, which is something that's going to help us a lot later on.
Yeah, well, I mean, they did set out to complete a project. They haven't made these for necessarily great film, but they've made them as almost archival footage of all Shakespeare's work. It's kind of like an addendum to the written work. It's kind of this idea of we've captured the essence of all the Shakespeare plays. And to be fair, they have done that. That is definitely something that I think they've achieved in this particular film version. But what I feel is that I don't think it has done Shakespeare, the work of Shakespeare. Not that, you know, obviously there are some people who consider Shakespeare a god, and I'm not necessarily one of those people, and I know you aren't either. But I think definitely there is an element where you want to sort of highlight the good stuff of Shakespeare. And in this play, there are some good bits, absolutely, which everybody knows and are the famous bits, but the rest of the play, look, there's a lot of sand around the gold nuggets.
Absolutely. And I mean, another thing to keep in mind about this particular adaptation is that it is 1978.
Yeah.
And it is very, very 1978.
Yeah.
It's also not a sort of modern adaptation. It is a period piece.
To a degree. Like, I feel that the periodness of it is definitely through a 1970s lens.
Well, absolutely.
A lot of the costuming and things like that are still definitely 1970s influenced.
In the 1600, the tights weren't quite so peachy.
Well, they didn't have lycra back then. They didn't have any elastic. So, you know, no one wore tights that looked like they weren't wearing anything.
Like, some of these tights looked like they were kind of velour, you know, moose knuckle material.
Oh, they were definitely moose knuckle material.
But to continue on with the costumes, the most important point, of course, is the hats. Now, as we go through this process of watching 39 plays, I'm recording various statistics on what we're doing. And one of the statistics I'm going to be recording is how many times do I write in my notes, nice hat? Because I love a good hat.
You do.
And this play has some absolute doozies. Just an absolute banger. The most important one is, of course, the hats worn by the characters of Rosalind and Celia at the beginning of the film, which... Yes. Kind of look like someone has upturned a bra on their head and covered it in gilt fabric.
A little bit. It also reminds me of a show that used to be on TV years and years ago called The Flying Nun.
Right.
With her headdress garb, like it was really big. And so it's kind of like a 16th century version of The Flying Nun for me, which is hilarious.
The second nice hat in this was a hat worn by Touchstone the Jester later on in the piece. And it's not a traditional jester's hat with the points and bells, but it was more of a sort of straight-up, foot-and-a-half-long Marge Simpson do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely conical-shaped.
Collapsible. So one could take... Yeah, absolutely phallic. The other thing I'd like to say about the adaptation of the work is that I understand that they tried to create sort of a work of Shakespearean canon. However, with this particular adaptation, you could have at least a little bit cut harder. There's a lot of boring things on screen. For example, Act 2, which is completely useless. There's a lot of stuff that was clearly put in there to provide cover for actors changing.
Yeah, but I mean, that's in modern theatre now. Like, have we not done musicals, especially recently, where there's a whole song just to cover a costume change?
Yes, I'm saying that when you put it on television, that presumably shouldn't be there.
Well, yes, but then at what point, at what line do you draw that something is not valid because it's clearly fill-in material? I'm talking, of course, about the part where two young boys run in to the field and start to sing to Touchstone while he's wooing his fiance.
And it's a classic Shakespearean song. Lots of Hey Nonny Nonnies.
Yeah, lots of Hey Nonny Nonnies.
Super, super long.
But made somewhat entertaining by the fact that these young children obviously have no camera skills and keep making the blooming camera the whole way through their song. It's entertaining, but otherwise it doesn't need to be there.
So you're agreeing with me then that there are definitely parts of the show that could be cut.
Yes.
So let's advocate to cut more of the words written by the greatest playwright who's ever lived.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff that can be cut in Shakespeare. Casting and individual performances, Luke.
Yes. So obviously the main thing to talk about in any production of As You Like It, but definitely in this production of As You Like It, is the character of Rosalind, who is an incredible female character written in 1599, but fantastic in a modern sense, just an incredibly well-rounded character. And Helen Mirren did the job one would expect Helen Mirren to do in that role, I think.
I agree with that. There were elements of her performance right at the beginning of the play, and I wasn't completely sold on this idea that, you know, she's this wonderful actor, and I was kind of waiting for more. But once she actually makes the transition into the costumed male disguise, yes, and her behavior, I really found that interesting, because instead of leaning hard, oh, I'm going to be a man, yeah, right, which is something you see in some productions of Shakespeare, is that when the character is disguised, they try to put on the aspect of what they think a stereotypical opposite gender is. I feel that Helen really sort of lent into this idea of the man she was disguised as was still effeminate and very casual and very genteel, rather than being a young lad.
See, to me, it felt like she was playing a young woman pretending to be a man who doesn't, yeah, really know what she was doing. And it was wonderful in that way. There's a lot of parts with her, especially when she is talking to her, at this point, the person who is wooing her, Orlando.
Mm-hmm.
She's talking to him later in the play, and it's shot with her facing away from him. And you can see the girlishness on her face.
Yes.
Which goes away as soon as she turns around back to them. She's back into, I'm Ganymede, I'm masculine.
Yeah, there's definitely the duality of the characters there.
There's also a wonderful part that happens in the first scene when we see her dressed as Ganymede, where she's dressed in a tunic and she's dressed in tights, mm-hmm, and she has a sword. But the sword, instead of wearing it on her hip, as you'd see a man wear a sword, she's literally wearing it between her legs in a very sort of phallic way, gripping it between her legs in, again, a very phallic way. And I can only think that it is a purposeful choice by her, because it's never drawn attention to, but it is exactly the kind of point you would expect to see from a great actress trying to think, okay, how does a young woman think men behave?
Yes, most definitely that was a choice by Helen.
Yeah.
100%.
I almost feel like it was cut around. It was you only saw it for the briefest time, but she's literally walking around just gripping herself. It's really fantastic.
Yes, and I think that's a beautiful example of the small glimpses we see of the potential bawdiness of this play. I think this play could be so much funnier if you leaned really hard into the sexuality of this play. Yeah. I feel like that this play was definitely written by Shakespeare to be a trashy thing for his stage. Absolutely. And I think we revere it too much, and you miss that good. Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, you miss all of the, you miss the dirty.
Yeah, you miss the dirty. And dirty is really what it needs to be for this, I feel. I also really liked the actor who played, I think the character's name is LeBeau.
Yes.
I just referred to him as Gossip Girl of the Court, because basically he approaches them right at the beginning of the thing, and the quote is, oh no, his mouth is so full of news, and then he proceeds to just talk and talk incessantly.
I wrote down that he has big C-3PO energy.
Yes, exactly. It's just that wonderful, big, oh yes, darling, kind of energy.
But he's got a fantastic look. He looks kind of like a cross between John Cleese and Bill Nye. And he's just wonderful. He's a shot in the arm of energy that the first two acts of this play really sorely need, especially considering that his entrance comes directly after the wrestling scene, which is the best scene in the entire play. But I digress. I personally think that Richard Pascoe playing Jaques and James Bolan playing Touchstone the Fool were both great. In general, I think it's a great play for that slightly more character actory sort of thing. It's not really a great play for your leading men. I mean, the closest thing to a leading man you have in the play is Orlando, who is a worthless character, utterly meaningless.
Well, here's the thing, though, is he utterly meaningless because of the production we saw, or is he utterly meaningless because it's a badly written play?
No, I think he's utterly meaningless because that's the best way to make a play about Rosalind work. I think if you made it a play about him, it wouldn't be anywhere near as good.
Yeah.
Because the play hinges on the best written character, which is Rosalind, doing Rosalind stuff.
Yeah.
And he's almost like, you know, a personified MacGuffin. It doesn't, he's just there to be a target for Rosalind to do things to and to have these fantastic conversations with. His character is important because you need to have someone to be a foil to Rosalind there.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that it's, I don't think anyone's gagging to play Orlando. I don't think anyone's writing down Orlando from As You Like It as the character I've always wished to play in the Shakespearean canon.
That's true. I agree with that.
I'm also not 100% sold on Angred Reads as Celia and Victoria Plucknett as Phoebe. It's kind of interesting. Those are both great roles. Those two women are great roles, but I think it'd be difficult to cast because I think they can get overshadowed quite a lot. And I think that's what's happened here.
I mean, yes, but I also know that the Phoebe monologues, especially from this show, are highly coveted because of the way that she speaks about Ganymede. And I know that they're very popular audition pieces. So it's kind of this idea that, you know, Rosalind and Phoebe, especially from this production, from this play, are not necessarily coveted roles, but there are definitely standout speeches from those characters that are highly coveted. So that, you know, it's kind of that thing of Shakespeare is that, like, you're listening and you kind of pick up certain things, but then when you hear something familiar, all of a sudden your ear really turns into it and you go, oh, I know that.
Well, a fantastic example of that is the most famous monologue, maybe from all of Shakespeare. Well, probably not from all of Shakespeare because Hamlet. But very, very famous Shakespearean monologue from this show, you know, all the world's a stage and all the men and women merely players.
Yes.
Comes from the show and is a great monologue.
Yep.
You know, delivered by Jaques, but doesn't really do anything in terms of the plot.
It just comes, it literally comes out of nowhere. Like there are two old dudes or a bunch of old dudes sitting around the forest yammering on, and I'm not gonna lie, I nodded, like I was not listening. I just was not interested. And I guarantee you that at this point is definitely where you would go for a pee break while they're rabbiting on. And then all of a sudden he turns around with this profound speech. But the thing is that it's in the middle of nowhere. It's not after anything, it's not before anything, because the next thing that happens is Orlando comes in to try and rob them because his old, I think a priest that lived on the estate with him, when they left the estate, was like, I'm strong and lusty. And then they get into the forest and he's like, oh, I'm dying. And so Orlando has to try and rob these guys to try and get some food for his dying priest, who we never actually see again for the entire show.
That happens. What you're talking about just there happens before the monologue. And then he's convinced by the Duke to go off and get this old servant that he's brought.
Yeah.
And as he's going off to get the old servant is when he delivers this monologue. So I guess the thematic link is that people get old, which is, I guess, what the whole monologue is about.
Yeah.
But I don't know really how that informs the show itself.
Oh, it's irrelevant to the actual play. Yeah.
Nothing to do with the plot, nothing to do with any of these other characters. Really, the worst parts of the show were the bits where Orlando was doing Orlando stuff. You know.
Although I have to say that one shot where it's revealed that Orlando is writing letters in the forest, that reveal shot, oh, mwah, pure absolute comic brilliance from the BBC there. I do want to give one shout out to the background and bit part actors of this production who did excellent work. They were just so wonderful to watch in the background. But also every so often they would get a line, and they clearly had a hard-on for Shakespeare. Like, they were just, the way they would deliver it would be just a little more dramatic. It was just funny. I liked it. I just wanted to give them a shout-out.
You're getting a paycheck. You might as well do something to work for it.
Yeah, okay.
So, the favourite plot points we have of the original play, I think you and I are both in agreement that the best scene in the play, which is also a very weird scene from a plot point of view, is the first scene where Orlando meets the bedraggled Rosalind, who is named Ganymede when she is in her male persona. Rosalind has found all of these poems that Orlando has written for her, and they interact for the first time. And the performance in that scene is just absolutely wonderful. From a writing point of view, from all the stuff that Rosalind is given to do, which is not stuff that I think would be traditionally given to a woman in these roles. You know, she definitely has the power in the conversation. She definitely pushes Orlando, I think. Do you agree?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I think that there's actually a common theme through Shakespeare's work that there is a strong female character that's pushing some action through it. And I think that appears more often than not. And I think that's fairly much attributed to the fact that he's writing in the time of Queen Elizabeth.
Absolutely.
And so that is an influence on his work, because of course you want to please your patron, whom she was through connections and whatever. And this isn't a history podcast, so I'm not going to go into that.
Yes.
But I think the context of the day is an influence in his work.
There's a fantastic quote from Germaine Greer talking about feminism and with regards to Shakespeare's work. And I don't believe that the question of whether or not Shakespeare is a feminist is particularly an interesting question. But what Germaine Greer said about it was that Shakespeare wasn't a feminist, he just wrote women as if they were people.
Yes.
And this is definitely an example of that. And I think Rosalind, the contrast between Rosalind and Celia is kind of a demonstration of that. Like, Celia seems to be very much a character who is a, you know, ditzy flibbertigibbet, and Rosalind is an actual person.
Yes. Yeah.
But just really, really fantastic scene. And Act 2 is so bad. Act 2 is so boring, and so little happens in Act 2 of this play, that the energy in that scene just wakes you up and is like, oh, I'm interested in this again now.
Yeah. Act 2 is definitely the pee break.
So what are other examples of scenes that particularly touched you in this play?
I think I definitely struggled with the plot point of, hey, I'm a strange dude in the woods and you've never met me before and I've never met you before and you should totally, like, flirt with me and try to hit on me as if I was your actual girlfriend, and I insist on you calling me your girlfriend's name. And Orlando being like, at first, oh, it seems a bit weird. No, dude, trust me, I got this. Okay. It's not like he had to twist Orlando's arm.
No.
You know, like, I just struggle with the plot point, you know? Also, if you're going to have a wedding conducted by a god, then, you know, there's no personification of that better than 1978's Hymen.
Oh, just absolutely wonderful. He literally looks like he's rolled off the Friends of Jesus hippie bus.
Whew.
Tossed on a toga and just walks out. I love the Deus Ex Machina. And yeah. This is literally a god walks in and marries everyone.
Which was very confusing for me because I had no idea what the heck was happening because I didn't realise there was a god in this play.
Yeah.
And so when this half-naked dude starts walking them in as if they look like they're straight out of a Greek mythology, I actually said while we were watching it on the couch, I was like, who's this dude? Like, where did he come from?
And it looks like Greek mythology because that's what he is.
Yeah, but I just, like, it's such a hard left turn that I just, you don't, there's no other mention that I can tell that of any sort of gods, you know, participating. And no one seems perturbed that this half-dressed man just suddenly appears. Like, it's just, yeah, look, I have problems with the play.
I mean, they're all getting what they want. They're all getting married. But for me personally,
mm-hmm.
The best part of the show, from a plotting point of view, occurs in Act 1.
Yeah.
Now, if you know anything about me, I am a big fan of professional wrestling. For me, pro wrestling is the truest form of theater that we have in the modern era. And definitely, if you took pro wrestling and put it in the Globe in 1600, they would 100% understand it.
Yeah.
It's very much that. And that's fantastic because in Act One, there is a wrestling match. And not just something that looks like a wrestling match. There is a whole plot point about Orlando going and wrestling the Duke's wrestler, who is Charles. By the way, I bet you dollars to donuts that when this was done in Shakespeare's day, the actor playing Charles was a famous wrestler. Because when you think about it, like, he's only in the first act.
Yeah.
And
it might have been a cameo, yeah.
Yeah, it just really, really feels like that. And God, I just absolutely, I adored it. It kind of scratched my itch to, you know, secretly be a wrestling podcaster. It's.
I wrote in my notes, wrestling, bringing people together since the 1500s.
Honestly, if you want to see Shakespeare the way it's meant to be done, go watch a pro wrestling show.
Yeah.
Or a Wu-Tang Clan concert. They're both exactly the same. But it's just really wonderful. I absolutely loved it. Now, that's what we liked. Let's nitpick a bit. What did you not like about this play that you've said five times that you didn't like?
I really struggle with this plot point of Orlando just agreeing to flirt with some dude in the forest. I think more specifically the fact that when Ganymede insists that he calls her Rosalind, that he's okay with that. Like, I would feel really uncomfortable if someone met me on the street and or came up to me while I was sitting in a park and said, "Hey, you seem to be in love with someone and I can help you not be in love anymore. I think you should flirt with me and call me Luke." And I kind of feel like that's it's just weird.
Look, I mean, one, first of all, Orlando as a character is clearly very stupid, clearly dumb as a sack of bricks. He's got a bit of the, you know, the physical intelligence as showed by the wrestling match.
But
as
it's not just that he's dumb enough to agree with it. It's the fact that she decides that this is the best course of action to woo the man she thinks she wants to marry.
Look, it's not the best course of action, certainly, but it is the funniest course of action.
Oh, yeah.
So, and
but that's where I come back to. If you're going to do this play, why not lean into the funny?
Well, you'd have to. It's a comedy, and this particular production does not bring the funny as often as maybe it should.
No, I don't think so. I definitely don't, especially considering that it's made in 1978 and my very stereotypical knowledge of the 70s being what it is. I feel like they missed a great opportunity to have lent into that real sexuality, bawdy, like, dirty nature of the play. Like, I think that would have helped it make sense. Like, you know, leaning into this idea that Orlando probably knows that Ganymede is Rosalind. You know what I mean? And just playing along, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
I mean, I don't know. Like I said before, I think he works best as a foil. And I think his knowing participation would make that scene less funny. But there's a bit of underlying knowledge there. Like the story of Ganymede in Greek mythology is a story of sort of homoerotic love.
Yeah.
And that's that kind of knowledge, which would have been fairly standard in the time when this was written, does make that scene a bit funnier because of, you know, this is what it appears to be, but what it actually is Rosalind tweaking his nose and doing it to make fun of this gentleman that she's decided is going to be her, you know, husband.
Yeah. Yeah. I also had a funny moment where we were watching the show and the moment came to me as randomly as my insertion into this podcast of this moment of the fact that the screen we were watching was square on our rectangle TV.
Well, it's 4x3, yeah, yeah. 4x3. Yeah, yeah. It's I think the only 4x3 things we're going to watch are going to be the BBC television productions.
Oh yeah, yeah, all the BBC ones, yeah.
It's
like I didn't notice it and then all of a sudden I did and then I couldn't unsee it.
Yes.
It was strange. What about you? What was your nitpicking?
I mean, my biggest point, I've already talked about All the World's a Stage and how it's fantastic but kind of useless.
Yeah.
There's lots of other stuff in this show that's fantastic, but mostly useless. There is a scene towards the end of the show where Touchstone delivers this long monologue about seven different arguments that people have. It's something that clearly exists to give people time on stage to, because I believe it happens as Ganymede leaves for the last time and she's about to come on as Rosalind, so there's got to be time there. But it's really long, and by, you know, act five, scene four, we're ready for this to be over. We're ready to wrap it up. And, you know, that's kind of my general nitpick with a whole bunch. There's a whole lot of stuff in this show that it drags at the beginning, it's fantastic in the middle, and then it drags again towards the end. It's only 2.5 hours long.
Well, I mean, this version was only 2.5 hours
yeah,
long.
Yeah, I suppose, but, you know, they didn't cut that much.
Yeah, they didn't cut that much, but when you think about the speed that film adds to the movement of things...
Yeah, I suppose.
Even though they didn't, like, cut a lot of the stuff where you could add movement through the magic of film, but... Even if it was a live play, there would be even more laboriousness between moments and things like that.
Yes. And the only other thing I would say in terms of the nitpicks and things about this play is the characters, the duo of Phoebe and Silvius, who are a pastoral couple of shepherds that exist in the world of the forest and are there for, I don't know, reasons passing understanding. I suppose they have a little bit of interaction with Rosalind, and Phoebe wants to marry Ganymede as Rosalind's drag king persona. It's not hugely necessary. I mean, she's a fantastic character.
It's almost like she's there to give evidence that Rosalind is a believable man. Like, so believable that another woman would fall in love with him.
I suppose.
And that's the only purpose she really serves in this particular plot point. And this is what I mean by, you know, if we need evidence that she's really that believable, then it makes it even weirder that Orlando's like, yeah, okay, I'll call you Rosalind and I'll flirt with you even though you're clearly a dude.
Yeah, sure.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's kind of, you can have one or the other. I have problems when you have both.
Yeah, the characters of Silvius and Phoebe could have been in any play. And a lot of their scenes, I think, probably were just written. And it's just these two people, this man who wants this woman to marry her and this woman who's not interested. And it feels like those scenes were just written. It's like, okay, this is a good place. Let's put them in this play that we're putting out. Same with All the World's a Stage.
Yeah.
It's probably a fantastic piece that he had written and said, well, it kind of works here, so we're going to put it in.
Yeah, I agree. Do you have any favourite quotes or moments from the play?
In general, the whole epilogue is excellent. So this is a scene where everyone's just got married in a mass wedding and they've had a dance, as all, you know, Shakespearean comedies have to end with everyone having a dance. And then Rosalind turns to the camera. It's the first thing that's addressed to the camera in the whole show. And she delivers us this epilogue. And the epilogue is about how weird epilogues are and how weird it is to have a woman delivering the epilogue. And it's just wonderful. It's just like the most wonderful little touch on the touch of garnish on the end of the play.
I mean, most of Shakespeare's plays have prologues and epilogues that are just not usually used. But my favourite part about this particular one and its use in this particular film is the fact that Helen looks directly in the camera, looks it straight down the barrel, and says, "If I were a woman..." And then takes a moment to raise her eyebrows in some kind of little sarcastic moment. Because obviously the original player delivering that line would have been a man. And so it's taken this opportunity of modernity to go, if I were a woman, raises eyebrows.
Yes.
Because of the fact that she is a woman and she can deliver this monologue, even though the original writer and the original intent was to make fun of the fact that it's clearly not a woman. But if they were, we would do this stereotypical thing.
Yes, and in the epilogue, there is a section where he says, good plays don't need epilogues, but good epilogues make plays better. And I can't tell whether or not this is a good play or a good epilogue.
Yes.
And that just seems to really focus in on Shakespeare's whole attitude towards this specific play.
Yes.
You know, it is definitely not high art.
No.
But I love that he acknowledged that. I love it when creatives kind of give a wink and a nod and say, you know, I know what this work is.
Mm.
Other quotes that I really, really liked and sections of writing specifically. Silvius, who is the stupid young shepherd who's looking to marry Phoebe, has a wonderful duologue from Act 5, Scene 2, which is him listing what love is. And it's kind of like 1 Corinthians from the Bible, but better because Shakespeare wrote it. And I want to see it at more weddings. It's really, really lovely. Phoebe has a monologue from Act 3, Scene 5 about the kind of man she'd marry. And it reads almost exactly the same as Benedict's similar monologue from Much Ado About Nothing. But just really, it's so very similar. Lots of like, I want a pretty man, not too pretty. You know, it's really great. There's Jake is a fantastic character, just melancholy, sad, dry, really great, like the character I'd love to play. And he has a wonderful moment with Rosalind where they're talking about him being a melancholy fellow. And he says, "'Tis good to be sad and say nothing." And she replies, "'Tis good to be a post." Which I think that's just really, really wonderful. But my favorite writing in this play was Shakespeare writing bad poetry. Both Orlando's poems about Rosalind that he staples to the trees, and also Phoebe's letter to Ganymede about how much she loves him and wants to be with him. Just really clearly him writing awful poetry on purpose.
Well, I mean, we assume it was on purpose.
No, it has to be. Like, because, look, let's put it this way. The man could write poetry, right?
Well, yes.
And this is the writing of someone who incredibly could not. And it almost feels like he's poking fun at someone.
I mean, it's possible that this play was an entire vehicle to, like, was a political thing at the time it was written where someone was criticizing Shakespeare's plays. And maybe it was someone who wasn't a great playwright or a great writer in general. And that person, Shakespeare's like, you know, maybe it was a public thing and people knew about it. And he was like, oh, you want to see, this is an example of this person's writing. And this is why we have these great passages throughout the piece that aren't really linked together because Shakespeare's demonstrating that he can write poetry and this is a total conspiracy theory and we should move on.
I mean, look, all I'll say is that there's two separate sections where Touchstone is criticizing the poetry, and his criticism of the poetry is much better poetry than the poetry itself.
Yeah.
He talks about the tree bearing bad fruit and saying that people need to make sure that people do not read poems ill-favoredly. And it's just, you know, I really liked it. I like that. I think it's ironic in the best way. What were your favorite quotes from the piece?
I definitely found a new great insult to add to my list. I love Shakespearean insults. They're wonderful. Right at the beginning of the play, the older brother of Orlando.
Oliver.
Oliver. Is that his name?
Yes.
Right.
It shows you how much the first bit of this play makes an impact.
Well, Oliver is talking to himself, i.e. the camera, about his brother Orlando, saying that I would physic your rankness. So basically saying, like, I would get rid of you out of my life. But yeah, I would physic your rankness. Just sounds wonderfully gritty. I also really loved, I don't remember who it was or why they said it or when they said it, but someone in the play said, I will kill you 150 ways.
It's really great.
It was just a wonderful delivery and I just laughed and it was just... Yeah, I really liked it.
So, would you watch this adaptation again?
No.
No.
I don't think I could watch this adaptation again.
Would you watch the show again? Would you watch As You Like It again?
I might. I'm on the fence about it. I think that I would consider trying the Branagh 2006 version that we mentioned at the top. Because when I read the Wikipedia page, it sounds like a real treat. But I think unless someone was making a parody version of this or like, who are the brothers that make films?
Coen brothers.
The Coen brothers. Like if the Coen brothers did a parody version of this movie, I think I could watch that most definitely. I think that would be hilarious. But for me, I think I'm just happy listening to the famous bits and giving the rest a miss.
Yeah. I mean, for me, it really depends. I don't think I'm going to seek out another film adaptation of it, but in terms of stage adaptations, it really depends on who's playing Rosalind. That's the whole ballgame. That's the entire show. This show is one character who is a phenomenal part, and if you had a phenomenal actor doing it, it would be fantastic. Like, I know lots of great female actors in Brisbane where we live, and giving them a chance to do this kind of role, I'd buy that ticket. That'd put my butt in a seat.
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
I still don't know that I'd see it again.
Oh.
But that's me, and we can disagree. We can do that because we're adults.
Absolutely. How many spears would you shake at this play?
3 spears.
Now, just to be clear, there isn't a scale that this is on.
The spears don't matter.
This rating system makes no sense. I would shake 2 spears at it, so less spears than you, which is weird because it seemed like I enjoyed it more than you, but I think I'm just a harder marker.
Yes, more than likely you are definitely a harder marker.
And now a sonnet that is not Sonnet 18.
Sonnet 134. So now I have confessed that he is thine, and I myself am mortgaged to thy will. Myself I'll forfeit, so that other mine thou wilt restore, to be my comfort still. But thou wilt not, nor he will not be free, for thou art covetous, and he is kind. He learned but shorty like to write for me under that bond that him as fast doth bind. The statute of thy beauty thou wilt take, thou usurer, that puttest forth all to use, and sue a friend came debtor for my sake, so him I lose through my unkind abuse. Him have I lost, thou hast both him and me. He pays the whole, yet am I not free. You've been listening to Heavenly Shows and Unnecessary Letters. You can follow us on the socials using HSAUL Podcast, where we will also make our show notes available. You can subscribe to Heavenly Shows and Unnecessary Letters anywhere good podcasts are available. Next time, we'll be watching the 2018 National Theatre's production of Antony and Cleopatra.
This podcast is produced in partnership with That's Not Canon Productions, and the music is by me, with editing by both Tammy and myself.
Thanks to William Shakespeare, Zane, Daryl, Scott, Janet, Bernadette, David, Emily, Kate, Peter and Jason for your help and mentorship. See you next time. While he's wooing some chick that he's found in, I assume, the local town with the biggest I've ever seen. Don't raise your eyebrows at me. What?
I just wasn't sure which curses we were allowed to say.
Is a curse?
It is, according to George Carlin, but that's fine. Let's keep
Who's
going.
Who's George Carlin?
Oh, dear.